So, Todd, can you believe that it's Palm Sunday already?
I'll tell you, each year, Easter seems to sneak up on me more and more. I was not expecting Palm Sunday to be here already.
Yeah, I know. I feel the same way. It's hard to believe that it's Easter already. So what are maybe some of your favorite memories from Easter?
I remember being in church as a kid, and I remember going to my grandmother's house after Sunday service for a meal, and I wouldn't say we had any great big traditions other than that, just having a meal together and being together as a family.
I remember waking up on Easter morning, and my parents would always hide like Easter baskets in the house.
And I do remember that.
And that was fun because it involved candy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about this morning as I saw the kids in the aisles with palm branches. It really did take me back because I remember being in church, waving the palm branches as a kid. And I often wondered what was going on that this time when Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem, that there was all this fanfare. Because he came and went from Jerusalem at other times, and it didn't look like this big parade sort of a thing.
Yeah, you're right. Jesus had come and entered Jerusalem before. But this particular time, he was coming with his disciples to celebrate the Passover feast. And there actually would have been Jews from all over the nation of Israel descending onto Jerusalem and entering the city from various directions to celebrate the Passover feast. And Jesus would have been very familiar, as you mentioned, with the city because his parents took him to the Passover feast every year when he was growing up. So he would have been in the city before and had been familiar with it, and he was there with his ministry. But this time was different in a couple of senses. First, there would have been quite a bit of to-do about the fact that he had just come from a nearby village of Bethany, and it was there where he raised Lazarus from the dead.
Okay.
And so that word would have been getting out. And many of the people that would have been traveling to Jerusalem with him, or around the same time, would have been from Galilee, where he had just come and done a lot of ministry and miracles, and so they would have been familiar with him and his miracles. And it's interesting, too, because they were looking for a political Messiah. They were looking for someone to come, and at the time they were occupied by the Romans, and they were looking for someone who would kick the Romans off their back and make them an independent state. It's interesting because back in the early part of John chapter 6, it says this: after the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." But Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to the mountain by himself. And so they at one point they wanted to make him king by force, and he kind of played that down. But now they thought, maybe this is the time. Maybe this is the moment when he's going to roll into town and become that political Messiah that we were hoping for.
So that explains a lot of that excitement.
Yeah, it explains a lot of excitement. So you got the whole festival atmosphere of the Passover feast. It would have been like a great big family reunion, and you got all this other stuff going underneath the surface of him.
So what's with the palm branches? And we even sung in the songs, they laid their coats on the street, and he's on a colt.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's not stuff that we do today. But the palm branches would have been a sign of victory in that culture. The laying down of the coats on the road would have been a sign of respect. And even the colt had significance because that would have been a sign of peace to them. Because normally when a king rode into town, he rode in on a horse.
See, when I was a kid, I thought Jesus and the disciples were just too poor to really afford a good horse. So he ended up on a colt.
Yeah, good horses were hard to come by.
And then I found out that really wasn't the reason.
Yeah, and the riding of the colt was actually a fulfillment of prophecy in Zechariah 9.
Okay.
So there was quite something that day. But the thing I've often wondered is like what was like they were chanting like King of the Jews. Like that's something I didn't always understand.
I didn't always understand that either. So when I go back and look at that, it turns out that clear back in the Old Testament, God is referred to as King of the Kings. And even as soon as Jesus was born, he was being called King of the Jews. In Matthew 2, verse 1, here's what it says. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews?"
Wow.
"We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him."
So that term was used for him, like right from the day one.
They recognized him as being the long-awaited king. And often, even Matthew refers back to the book of Malachi, and he says, which says this: "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel."
Okay.
And there was prophets at the time who recognized when Jesus arrived that he was that long-awaited Messiah. In other words, the King of the Jews. Another thing I find interesting is that even as Jesus is called King of the Jews, he never rejects that title.
Okay.
All through his life.
Never downplays that or tells people that's not true.
No. In fact, that's the charge they brought against him there on Good Friday, was being King of the Jews. Now, keep in mind, when he came into the city, they were chanting King of the Jews and hailing his name as honorable and as respect for him. But by the time we get to Friday, we're seeing that they're starting to turn that term and use it against him.
So it went from a term of honor to a term of shame.
Yeah, in fact, the soldiers who were getting ready to put Jesus on the cross, it says that they gathered around him, that they hit him, they spit on him, and they bowed down in a mocking way, saying, "All hail the King of the Jews." And they were teasing and mocking. And even to the point where that's what they hung on the cross over his head when he hung on the cross, was King of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
They did it to mock him. But that sign couldn't have been more true, because
right.
he was King of
wow.
the Jews.
Okay.
He was the long-awaited Messiah. Now you might say, well, okay, that's a great history lesson, but what about today? What's that have to do with Palm Sunday here, 2012? Well, I'm reminded in this story that I have to make that decision for myself.
Right.
And we all need to make that decision. Is he going to be King of Kings, King of our lives? Are we going to take that mocking approach and use his name in vain and belittle him? Are we going to say, "You are King of Kings over my life"? You know, even as I think about that term, King of Kings, going from something honoring to mocking him, it's always amazing to me that Jesus entered the city under this celebration, and then by Friday, he's hanging on a cross. I mean, how do you explain that, that it went like that?
That is amazing, isn't it, when you think about that, from being celebrated to hanging on a cross. And as I looked at that, I mean, one of the things I discovered is that there, you know, it seems kind of crazy that he went from being celebrated to hanging on a cross, but if you look at his life and ministry, from the very get-go, his ministry, he was kind of ruffling the feathers of the religious leaders. And so there would have been this long-standing history of tension between Jesus and the religious leaders long before he ever shows up at Jerusalem.
So that's kind of the background going on. While some people are celebrating him, others are hating him.
And in fact, we call it the triumphal entry, but in one sense, it was only triumphal for those who were there at the moment and were following him and were kind of caught up in this Jesus for president kind of, you know, excitement.
Feeling or something.
Feeling, yeah. So in fact, if you go back to Luke in chapter 6, this would have been long before he gets to Jerusalem. This would have been actually up in Galilee, a day's journey or more away. And it says this, after he had healed a man on the Sabbath, it says, "But they," referring to the religious leaders, "were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus."
And not in a good way.
Not in a good way, right. They were
trying to get rid of
them. They were upset. They were angry. They were furious. I mean, that's some strong language. And so Jesus then enters Jerusalem with this kind of long-standing tension as, you know, kind of in the background. And then the whole events, the festive atmosphere of the week, plus some of the events that happened, would have just kind of increased that tension to a boiling point. For instance, when Jesus strolls into the city, the first thing he does is he goes to the temple. And he discovers that there are Jews there that are selling sacrificial lambs to the travelers, which that in and of itself wasn't wrong, but they were charging an exorbitant amount of money for these lambs, and they were ripping them off. And that angered Jesus. So he turned the tables.
Oh, that's when that whole
He turned the tables
scene
on
happened.
Yeah, that's where that whole scene happens. And then every day he shows up in the temple courts and he begins to teach. And he's drawing big crowds, which also probably would have ruffled the feathers of the religious leaders. Meanwhile, they continually kind of come after him and try to trap him in his words and he kind of keeps deferring that trapping. So you just kind of see this tension's building, and it's reaching a boiling point this week. And we looked at Luke chapter 6. If you go to Luke chapter 19, this is now during that week. It says this: every day he, being Jesus, was teaching in the temple courts. But the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it because all the people hung on his words. And so by this point, they're done discussing what are we going to do with Jesus. They've already decided.
They already have that plan.
They already have a plan. We got to kill him. We got to get rid of him. It's just a matter of how do we pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can just see that this tension has been building.
Well, Jim, what I've discovered is it wasn't just that the religious leaders of the day didn't like him because he was teaching. It was what he was saying.
Okay.
He was saying that he was the Messiah. And I've had conversations with people that think a little bit along the lines of saying, well, Jesus was a great teacher, or he was a prophet, some kind of religious leader. But what they misunderstand is Jesus himself claims many times through Scripture to be the Messiah. Here's one of those first times where he really makes it clear. He was spending some time with his disciples, and this is what we read in Matthew 16:13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And he meant himself. He referred to himself as Son of Man at times. So he was saying, who are people saying that I am? But they replied, who do you think is going to reply first?
Probably Peter.
It's always Peter, right?
It's always
Peter. Peter's
always
the disciple that jumps in right there. Some were saying John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And still others Jeremiah or one of the other prophets. But what about you, he said to the disciples. Who do you say I am? And there was Simon Peter jumping in, and he said, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, catch what Jesus says at that point. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by men, but my Father in heaven. The religious leaders were starting to hear him talk like that.
So they knew what he was claiming.
And you would think that it would be those people who were loving God and worshiping God and religious leaders in the community, you would think they would be like his number one cheerleader.
Yeah.
Because they were expecting the Messiah to come. The problem was...
Yeah, what were they looking for in Messiah?
They were looking for something more like a political leader who would come to those Jewish leaders and almost kind of bow down to them and
right.
lift them up as Elevate. Powerful people in the community. The problem is that's not God's heart.
Yeah.
When God shows up in the flesh, in the person of Jesus Christ, he is kind, giving, and serving, opposite of what many of those religious leaders were. Think of the irony. Jesus is with the Samaritan woman at the well, and we heard about that recently here in church. The woman said to Jesus after they talked a while, she said, I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I who speak to you am he.
So he stated it outright.
He says it outright. And these types of instances are what's getting those religious leaders upset.
Yeah.
Because why would the Messiah hang out with people that the religious leaders kind of pushed aside in society?
Right.
But that's exactly the heart of God. God's not looking for people who think they're religious. He's looking for people who are humble and willing to see him in their lives as the Messiah. That's our challenge today, quite honestly.
Yep.
It's easy to point a finger at the Pharisees and these others we read about, but we have to make the same choice.
Yep.
Am I going to be like the Pharisees, or am I going to be like Peter or the woman at the well?
Yeah.
Am I going to reject him, or am I going to accept him as Messiah of my life? So is he the Messiah? Well, we've journeyed from Sunday and through the week, and now here we are, Thursday night, sitting at the table here in the upper room. I'm sure that didn't look exactly like this table, but let's talk a little bit about this table, what it means, and why the disciples were gathered together there that night on Thursday night of Passion Week.
Yeah, we don't know what it looked like. We have a picture up here of the Leonardo da Vinci painting of the Last Supper, and we probably didn't look like this. It probably didn't totally look like that. If for no other reason, I don't think the disciples were all on the same side of the table.
No, I always wondered about that.
But when you do a painting, I guess to draw the back of disciples is not a good thing. But the Passover feast that Jesus was coming into Jerusalem to celebrate with his disciples would have been a yearly feast that the Jewish people would have celebrated. It was the most sacred of all the feasts that they had. I liken it to it just a little bit. If you think about it, like how your feeling is when you go to Thanksgiving, if it's like your family, we go to Thanksgiving and there's going to be a turkey, and then there's going to be certain side dishes, and the side dishes are the same every year. And because of this,
canned cranberries.
Right. And you don't eat them any other time of the year.
Never.
And I don't eat them on Thanksgiving.
I don't even know if you can buy them at other
times. I don't know either if you can buy them at other times. But because you eat those dishes only once a year, they have significance. Well, think about that in your minds and then take it to another level. The disciples would have come to this table and it would have been like that only more so because this was the most sacred feast of their year. This, mm-hmm. When Jesus and the disciples got to this table, this would have been something that the Jews would have been celebrating for close to 1,500 years. So there is quite a depth of history there. Mm-hmm. Now, this feast takes us back to the time when they were early in their nation. If you remember, there was a famine in the land, in the promised land that God took Abraham to. They left the promised land to go to Egypt to survive the famine. Mm-hmm. During that time, they became enslaved to the Egyptians. And after 400 plus years, God raised up Moses.
Yep.
And said, okay, it's time to set my people free. And so Moses goes before the Pharaoh and says, our people need to be free. And the Pharaoh says, there's no way. Why? Because they were enslaved. And they were doing all the hard labor for the Egyptians. So that God said, okay, I'm going to send 10 plagues. And at the end of that time, they're going to let you go. And plague after plague after plague comes, and they don't let them go. And God says, okay, I got one more. And so he says, I'm going to send a death angel through Egypt. And I'm going to kill the firstborn male of every family and even of the animals. But he says to Moses and the people of Israel, to avoid that plague, I want you to take a male lamb, perfect male lamb. I want you to kill the lamb. I want you to spread the blood on the doorposts and frame of your house. When you've done that, I want you to roast the lamb. I want you to eat it as a family. When you're done eating, I want you to get ready because you're going to be moving. And we read about this over in Exodus chapter 12. I just want to read a few verses here. This is God speaking. He says, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals. And I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And that's where we get the term Passover.
Mm-hmm.
No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is a day you are to commemorate for generations to come. You shall celebrate as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. And so it's because of that that the Jews for close to 1,500 years celebrated the Passover every year. So when Jesus and the disciples got here, there would have been a lot of meaning to it for them. Now, there would have been a number of elements on this table. We've only selected a couple as it relates to communion, three of the elements that were probably pretty significant for our discussion here this morning was the lamb, the unleavened bread, and the cup that was juice or wine. And every year when the Jews would have celebrated this feast, the fact that they had to sacrifice a lamb would have been one of the reminders for them that they needed a blood sacrifice for the covering of their sin.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we need to realize is that when Jesus took the cup that night in the upper room and said, this is going to represent my blood, they would have understood the dynamics of a blood sacrifice.
Right.
But even those men on that night didn't know what was coming the next day.
Right.
I think back to a verse in the Old Testament that gives us a little clarity on that. It's from Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11. For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. So as Jesus held that cup up and talked about us remembering his blood, he was making that transition to what we call the new covenant. When he says the new covenant in my blood, here's how 2 Corinthians 5:21 puts it. God made him, meaning Jesus, who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. So Jesus was using that whole symbolism that God introduced way back in the Old Testament as saying, my blood now is going to be the sufficient sacrifice for mankind.
So that kind of explains the significance of the cup. What about the bread? What do you know about that?
The bread's interesting too, because this wasn't the first time that Jesus used the word or the metaphor of bread for his life. One of the first times he used it was when he taught and fed the 5,000. Most people have heard of that story in the Bible.
5 loaves, 2 fishes.
Yeah, exactly. So at the end of that time, he's talking with his disciples, and he says, you know, there's such thing as spiritual bread. There's a time coming when there's going to be better bread, bread that's not going to perish. And in fact, Jesus said at that time, I am the bread of life. So when Jesus tells us to take the bread and to remember him, it's such a great symbol, because bread, even to today, in almost every culture, is synonymous with life.
It's like a staple.
Yeah, when we cut it down to the bottom line, we use the term bread and water. Bread is a staple. When Jesus was saying, remember me and use the bread, he's making a connection to his own life and saying that his life has saving and sustaining power. So when we take the bread and the cup, that reminds us of his body and his blood broken on our behalf. And for us today, we realize that he was the final Passover lamb. We call him the Lamb of God. That's where that comes from. Because we don't need to sacrifice lambs anymore, because we had the perfect, holy one of God who sacrificed his life in our place.
So that's where that term Lamb of God came from.
Yep. So even today, not only was he King of Kings, Messiah, he's also the Lamb.